her computer. There were fewer missing local men with the initial H than she'd expected, but she still sighed at the thought of having to check each one. Kat stared at the names, grabbed a pen and a memo pad and scribbled. Badly broken right wrist, gold ring, sandy hair. She picked up the phone.
"Could I speak to Miss Layla Hayes, please?"
"Hello, Mrs. Hayes, it's Detective Constable Kat Cullen here from Greenborough CID. Now, we don't want to cause you any distress, but we wondered if..."
Chapter 4 Nikki could not get the name Zena Paris out of her head. By 11 that morning, she gave in and picked up her car keys. She would pay the woman a visit. Nikki backed into a less than generous space in a side road off the high street. She had passed the upmarket antique shop hundreds of times, always passed it because it looked so damned expensive. She pushed open the heavy front door and entered a showroom redolent of old-fashioned wax polish and potpourri. To one side of the shop, an elegant couple were examining an enormous, ornately carved mirror. Nikki thought it was hideous, and wondered where these two lived. A warehouse, an aircraft hangar. She picked up a small china figurine and swallowed hard when she saw the price tag. She placed it very gently back on the rosewood cabinet.
"Were you looking for anything in particular, madam, or are you happy just browsing?"
"Oh, I'm fine, thank you."
She beamed at the beautiful young man who had materialized beside her as soon as her hand touched porcelain. He wore a cream jumper and had impossibly slim hips and the eyes of a Jersey cow.
"Such lovely things! It must be a real pleasure to work here."
Even she hardly recognized her own accent. She hoped he would not notice her outfit. It didn't quite match the upper-class vowels, being rather more M&S than D&G. His reply lacked conviction.
"Ah, yes, as you say, a real pleasure."
Why the veiled sarcasm, Nikki wondered.
"Mark, when you are free, Mrs. Curtis Webb requires assistance to her car."
The young man jumped and all but saluted. At least that was solved. The voice was deep and distinctly intimidating. She moved around a mahogany toolboy and surveyed the woman fussing over the overdressed and overweight Mrs. Curtis Webb. Although the shop had been in operation for over 5 years, Nikki had never met its owner. But Nikki knew she was looking at Zena Paris. Her tight iron-grey curls were cut short. She wore very little makeup, tailored navy slacks, a three-quarter-length jacket and a pale blue shirt with a Wedgwood cameo brooch at the neck. Her accent was pure girls' boarding school, and Nikki thought she looked as hard as nails. It made her wonder about the alleged friendship with Madeline Prospero, who had apparently been quiet and unassuming.
"Not like that, Mark, for heaven's sake. Bubble wrap the legs first. It's managed to survive since the early 19th century without damage. It would be nice if it could remain intact at least until Mrs. Curtis Brown gets it home."
Nikki slipped unnoticed from the shop. It didn't seem like a good time for introductions. She was pretty certain that Zena Paris had not even seen her, which would prove advantageous should she need to interview her officially. Back at her car and about to drive off, she suddenly remembered that another very surprising name on Spooky's list worked close to where she was parked. This time, it was someone she was on good terms with. She would not have to creep into this shop wearing a false moustache and dark glasses.
"Nikki! Haven't seen you for ages. Come on in. Time for a coffee and a Danish?"
"I always have time for a Danish, Denise. How are you?"
"Great, actually."
The plump, smiling woman wiped her hands on a tea towel and called out for one of her waitresses to bring two cappuccinos. She flopped down into a chair opposite Nikki and grinned at her.
"I've just heard that I've finally been granted planning permission to extend the coffee shop. I'll be able to do proper lunches and maybe dinner as well."
"That's fantastic, then. I bet Rosemary is thrilled."
Denise smiled warmly.
"Too right. She's fought for almost 2 years to get this through. I'd have given up ages ago, but you know what a terrier she is. No way was she going to back down. Building work can go ahead before the end of the month."
"What exactly are you going to do?"
"I'll show you the plans if you like. Hey, no, why don't you and Joseph come round for supper one evening? I'll give you the full guided tour. I'll make sure Rosemary is free too. We can catch up on all the gossip."
"Love to. I need to check with Joseph, though. His daughter got married a couple of weeks ago, and he's helping them get their tumble-down cottage livable."
She laughed. "But I'll certainly come. I'll ring you and we'll make a date." Nicky disliked cosy, girly evenings, but she was interested in local gossip. Cousin Denise's coffee shop was a fount of local knowledge. Denise beamed at her.
Smashing! I'll look forward to that!
The coffees arrived, and Denise told Nicky the story of their long battle, and Rosemary Allsop's tenacity in fighting for the cafe's right to extend.
I think even she thought we'd had it when the surveyor turned up that old well in the backyard. Half the Greenborough History Society was up in arms about it. They wanted it preserved for posterity. Bloody dangerous thing. Sooner it's filled in, the better, I reckon. It's only a hole in the ground, for heaven's sake. Anyway, Rosemary won in the end. As long as the work is done officially, we can go ahead.
I suppose you can't just tip a load of hardcore down and build on top of it, can you?
Some would, I've no doubt, but we'll do it properly, although I'm dreading getting the estimate.
They talked on. Nicky was careful not to mention the briar patch or the deceased Miss Prospero. She wanted the name Nicky Galena to remain above suspicion as far as the club was concerned. She finished her coffee and glanced at her watch.
"Look, Den, I really have to go. Give my regards to Rosemary, and I'll talk to Joseph and ring you at the weekend."
Nicky reached into her bag and found her purse.
"You can just put that away, detective. Building work or not, I can still afford to give my cousin a cup of coffee."
One didn't argue with the 16-stone Denise Fowler, so Nicky thanked her and left. Still smiling, Nicky went back to her car. She liked Denise. They were not first cousins, but they behaved like they were. Denise was a kind of second cousin once removed. They were of similar age and had been great friends as children. From their early teens, Nicky had been aware that Denise was different, although her cousin never admitted it. She still didn't. Her friend Rosemary was always just that, a close friend. Which was fine by Nicky. It was their business. Nicky kicked a battered Coke can into the gutter and tried to imagine how she would act if she were in that position. She had a no-nonsense, forthright attitude to most things, but she kept her emotions to herself. In that regard, she was a very private person. She wasn't a joiner, and wouldn't be heading up a gay pride rally or waving a rainbow flag. A lot had happened in her personal life, most of it traumatic, but she really wasn't sure how she would have dealt with an issue of sexuality. Nicky experienced a sudden wave of overwhelming sorrow. There were so many women like Madeline Prospero, who could never be as they wanted to. Being forced to live a lie, every minute of every day, was no life at all, was it? She slammed the car door and sighed. She looked at her eyes in the rearview mirror and knew what she would do. She would find Madeline's killer, and she would keep her secret. She wasn't sure how that could be achieved, but whatever it took, she'd do it. She was about to start the car when her phone rang.
"Sorry to call, Nicky. Are you anywhere near Churchgate Mews?"
"I'm three roads away, Joseph. What's the problem?"
"Uniform had to make a forced entry to number 22. Neighbours reported seeing daily papers sticking out of an old chap's letterbox, and his curtains hadn't been opened. Yvonne attended and found him in bed. She's confirmed that life is extinct. At first she thought it was a natural death, but now she thinks it could be suicide. She has asked if we could take a look."
"Has the doctor been called?"
"Yes, Nicky. And the coroner's officer was on site, so he's been notified too. Shall I meet you there?"
"If you would, Joseph, and bring the relevant paperwork. I'm on my way."
Kept himself to himself, apparently. No visitors to speak of, and he rarely went out. His next-door neighbour says he's in his early 70s, but he looks much older. Yvonne is in with the neighbour now. She's elderly and really upset, so Vonnie's making her a cuppa.
Pretty house proud, wasn't he?
Nicky ran a finger along the front of the shelf.
No dust?
No dishes in the sink. No clothes drying anywhere.
Joseph ran an envious eye around the place.
It's even tidier than my cottage, and Tam is convinced I have OCD.
Joseph opened the bedroom door.
He's through here, Nicky. Yvonne thought he'd had a heart attack or something. Until she saw those.
In a neat pile beside the bed were dozens of letters, photos, and old newspaper clippings. Beside them, and partly obscured, were some torn foil blister packs, now empty.
Antidepressants, I think.
He lay in bed in his pyjamas. Nicky looked at his cadaverous face. The man certainly looked older than 70. More like 80, Nicky thought. His skin was deeply furrowed and leathery, as if he had spent his time outdoors. One arm lay stiffly on top of the bedspread. The joints of his finger were large and knotty with arthritis, but the nails were clean and neatly clipped. Nicky bent down towards the dead hand and sniffed. There was the unmistakable smell of bleach.
"Do we know who he is?"
"The neighbour only knows him as Fred, but most of these letters are addressed to Mr. F. S. Cartwright." Yvonne didn't touch anything else, but by the looks of it, I'm sure all his bills and papers will be as orderly as the rest of his home. He was renting, so I've radioed in for a check on his name. Poor old guy. Seems like loneliness and failing health got the better of him, doesn't it?
Nicky looked around at the immaculate room and frowned. "Joseph, how many sudden deaths have you attended, where the place looks like a TV advert for Flash?"
Joseph raised his eyebrows.
"None. Come to think of it, most of them are a right shambles."
They usually let themselves go before they give up altogether. This looks as though he was expecting royalty."
"Maybe he was, but they never turned up."
"Now there's the point, Joseph."
Yvonne came into the room.
"Ever see someone do themselves in such a spotless place, Bonnie?"
Nicky asked.
Yvonne shook her head.
We are usually picking our way through empty baked bean cans, bottles and fag ends."
Nicky looked around.
"We better make sure that this is Frederick Cartwright. Yvonne, bag up all those tablet containers and see if there are any boxes with the pharmacy labels on them. Joseph, check for his personal papers, pension details, driving license and the like. It doesn't look like anyone else has been in here, but I would like to know if he did kill himself intentionally, and if he did, why?"
"Mom?"
Yvonne was looking out of the window.
"Doctor's just pulling up."
"Good," Nicky said, and whispered.
"Which one is it?"
"Dr. Weldon, by the look of it."
Yvonne gave a wry smile.
"Weedy Weldon himself."
"Oh, great. My favourite."
With a gloved finger and obvious distaste, Dr. Wallace Weldon touched the side of the dead man's neck and agreed that life was indeed extinct. He hurried to the door.
"Better get the paperwork done. I'll go into the living room and sort it out."
"Sorry, Doctor, one moment. Would you consider this a natural death, an accidental one, or a suicide?" Nicky's eyes were slivers of ice. Dr. Weldon raised his eyebrows.
"Looks like a suicide, but we'll have to wait for the post-mortem to be sure."
"And these, what would these have been prescribed for?"
Nicky held out the see-through evidence bag. He took it and turned the foil sheets towards the light.
"Tofranil. That's imipramine hydrochloride, a tricyclic antidepressant, often used with the elderly for depression."
"Is this man a patient of yours?"
"No, I've never seen him before. He's probably registered with the Fenside surgery. It's within walking distance of here."
"And how long, approximately, of course, has he been dead?"
The doctor brushed a liberal coating of dandruff from his suit collar and stared across the room at the dead man.
"Probably over 12 hours. Rigor mortis is well advanced. As I said, the post-mortem will tell you all you want to know, Detective Inspector."
Nicky wished that Rory Wilkinson was here. Dr. Weldon could hardly bring himself to touch the luckless Frederick Cartwright, let alone conduct anything approximating to a thorough and sympathetic examination. Looking relieved, the doctor mizzled off.
"Nicky, I've confirmed that he is Frederick Silas Cartwright, a widower. He kept all his personal papers together in a small case in the bottom of his sideboard, including his photo ID bus pass."
"Okay, Joseph, we'll take it all back with us and see if we can find any relatives. Better call the undertaker, I suppose."
"Already done. When I saw Weldon's car arrive, I knew the examination wouldn't take long."
Joseph rolled his eyes.
"Then I don't think that there is much more for us here. Get the doctor's comments and signature for me. Yvonne, would you stay here and see in the body bag, boys? Then get back to base. I'll see you there."
Nicky gave a curt nod to Wallace Weldon and a brief word of thanks. Tucked under her arm was a bag of photos, newspaper articles and letters. She had a distinctly uneasy feeling about the death of Mr. Fred Cartwright. Not only was it the cleanest scene of death or suicide that she had ever seen, but the dead man himself intrigued her. Maybe his bedtime reading would clarify matters.
Chapter 5. Several hours later, Nicky and Joseph stood in the CID room and stared at the big whiteboard that covered part of one wall. Along with names, times, and other notes, was a copy of a studio portrait of Madeline Prospero, provided by her father. Beneath it were images provided by the police photographer. The pretty, petite, sandy-haired woman in the centre portrait was no longer recognisable. As Rory had said, the attack was frenzied.
We've seen a lot of terrible things, haven't we, Joseph? But this takes Vicious to a whole other level.
Whoever killed Madeline was completely out of control.
Joseph looked at the picture and shook his head.
It's horrible.
Nicky looked at him. Insanity? Rage? Fury?
Could be drugs.
His voice was soft.
I saw something like this once when I was serving abroad. A young squaddie got completely off his head on something. It took four of us to get him to the floor, and he literally bit chunks of flesh out of one of the guys.
Joseph shuddered.
I never want to see anything like that again.
You could be right. With a sigh, Nicky walked back to her office, closely followed by Joseph. She sat down heavily and pointed to the other chair.
Do you know, for once, I have no idea where to start.
Joseph rubbed his chin.
I know what you mean. All the initial groundwork has been done. We've interviewed people, checked the CCTV footage of the area, and conducted background searches. We've spoken to friends, family, and work colleagues, but still nothing. Now we know we were chasing a false lead with the boyfriends, but what else don't we know about her?
We'll have to start looking at the Briar Patch woman. Nicky nibbled on her bottom lip.
And that is going to be like poking a stick into a hornet's nest. I don't want any of us getting stung. When are you seeing Spooky again?
Her interview for the post of coordinator of the new IT unit is on Friday. I'll see her then.
That's only the day after tomorrow. Until then, let's help Cat with the mystery man. I get the feeling you would like to take a swift look through the late Frederick Cartwright's papers. You keep staring hungrily at that brown envelope on your desk.
Joseph smiled. Nicky smiled back.
You know me so well.
That squeaky clean flat was all wrong for a suicide. She narrowed her eyes. And did you see that posy of freesias and a little vase on the kitchen table? Why buy flowers when you were planning on going away forever?
Joseph stood up. Well, I can't answer that one. I think I'll go and offer my services to Cat, and leave you to your musings on the strange passing of Mr. Clean.
Could you see if Yvonne is around, and tell her to come and see me?
Joseph nodded, and pulled the door to behind him. Nicky took out the collection of photos, letters, and paper clippings, and spread them over her desk. The pictures were very old, and most were family snaps, small, faded photos taken with an old-fashioned camera. Many showed a middle-aged woman, although it was difficult to make out her true age, but the majority followed a young girl from babyhood to adolescence. Fred himself featured only in one, a wedding gathering, and she would not have known that but for the penciled annotation, Fred and Ellen at Cousin Billy's wedding, March 1967.
"You want to see me, Mom?"
"Come in and grab a pew, Yvonne, and tell me what you've got on Cartwright." Yvonne Collins sat down and stared at her notes.
"Not a lot yet. He's lived in that small bungalow for about 6 years. It seems that he was a real loner. His old neighbour says he was always polite, but he rarely spoke about anything other than his little garden and his dog."
"Dog? I didn't see any signs of an animal living there."
"The neighbour is looking after it. Cracking little terrier it is. She said that Fred asked her to have it for a couple of days, as he had something important to do and he didn't want to neglect the dog."
"Sounds like he thought this through quite carefully, doesn't it?"
Although the old dear says she can't keep the dog permanently. It would be too much for her with her arthritis."
Yvonne gave her a rueful smile.
"I asked her if she would be kind enough to keep it for a few more days, if I paid for the food, to spare it going to the pound. You know what happens there. I thought I'd make a few inquiries about rehoming it."
Nicky nodded. "Fair enough. Did she tell you anything else?"
"Well, those particular dwellings belong to a housing association that provides homes specifically for the elderly of Greenborough and its villages, which means he's always lived in this area."
"What about a previous address?"
"That's a bit vague, Mom. Seems he was staying with an unmarried sister while he waited to be housed. She died just before he was given number 22. I contacted the housing people, but they don't seem to have kept any records on her, or where he came from originally."
"Helpful. What about his wife? I've got a photo of her here. Ellen Cartwright?"
Yvonne thumbed through her notes.
"Ellen Doris Cartwright, née Devers. Born in Hull, 1944. Married Frederick in St. Mary the Virgin's Church, West Saltaby, in 1962. She died of pneumonia in 1984.
And children?
An only child, a daughter called Millicent. She appears to have gone out to New Zealand in her late teens. So far, I haven't come up with anything else about her. No address, no details of whether she married. Nothing."
"And this, I suppose, was Millicent. Nicky laid out the old photos and turned them towards Yvonne. They seemed to stop at about the age of 10 or 11, and these, she pushed across a small bundle of airmail letters, were all returned from Christchurch, New Zealand, unopened, and marked not known at this address. Oh, well, that gives me somewhere to start, doesn't it? I mean, we have to try and locate her, to let her know that her father has died. Yvonne frowned. I don't think you'll have to go chasing around the Southern Hemisphere, Yvonne. Think about it. It was something Joseph said. Joseph said that he'd made the place look as if he was expecting royalty. So, who would you treat like royalty if you were Fred's age? A son or daughter? Or even a grandchild? Exactly. And he wanted to impress. He wanted them to see that he was coping, looking after himself, was in the pink, in fact. But the prodigal never showed. And then he topped himself. Pound to a penny. The pictures, the letters, the tablets. We hardly need the post-mortem report to confirm it's suicide. And if Millicent was supposedly calling on Daddy, she's not in New Zealand. She's right here. Of course. Oh, when you mentioned the tablets, well, he was with the Fenside surgery. He had been prescribed the antidepressants about a year ago. Looks like he only took a few of them and stockpiled the rest. While Yvonne talked, she leafed idly through the scattered photographs. She paused and stared hard at the wedding group. She turned it over, read the words on the back, and screwed up her face. Fred and Ellen. Fred and Ellen Cartwright rings a bell, ma'am.
With your encyclopedic knowledge of the people round here, I'm not surprised. Any idea where from?
Yvonne continued to frown.
Way back, I think. I'll have to spend some time on this. By the way, what was in the newspaper cuttings?
Can't make sense of them, Vonnie. He had kept mainly whole pages, so I can't tell which articles he was interested in. There was nothing about any particular person, and no mention of a Millicent.
Can I look at them?
Sure, take them with you. Copy them. And when you've finished with them, seal them up with his private papers. They'll be needed for the inquest.
Yvonne slipped the pages back into the envelope. I'll get on with trying to trace her daughter.
She paused in the doorway.
I wonder why she didn't show.
I wonder why she emigrated in the first place, and then made no contact for almost 25 years. Yvonne shrugged and left.
Nothing?
Cat asked, staring at the missing persons list and looking despondent. Joseph was stretching and yawning.
Nothing.
Same here.
Cat yawned too.
Found one chap with a broken wrist, got all excited. Then I realised he was only 5'3". Our chap was nearer 5'10". I've still got 6 or 7 to go. How about you?
2 or 3. But I think I'm going to call it a day. I've got a load of stuff to run over to Jacob's Mere. Tam and Niall will be home tomorrow, and I promise to get some food in for them. Their flight gets in pretty late.
Cat held out her hand. Pass them over, Sarge. I'm not doing anything tonight, so I'll keep phoning round.
If it's no trouble, Cat, I'd appreciate it. Mind you, I guess there is no hurry, really. He's been lying in that churchyard for long enough, so another few days won't make much difference.
I'm fine. I'll finish this lot. It's a good time to catch people in, and Dave hasn't surfaced either. I'll see how he's doing with the archive newspaper reports. Get yourself off and sort out your newlyweds.
Joseph pulled on his jacket.
Thanks, Cat. It's good of you.
He stopped and turned to her.
Big day tomorrow, isn't it?
The new arrival?
Ben's a good detective. I'm sure he'll fit in really well.
He will. Cat beamed. I'll make damn sure he does.
I'm sure you will. Now don't work too late. This case doesn't qualify for overtime rates, you know.
Sarge, you know me. I do it all for love.
A few moments after Joseph left, Dave slumped at his desk and sighed loudly.
I've got square bloody eyes.
Cat laughed.
But have you got anything interesting?
I honestly don't know.
He stared at the mountain of papers in front of him.
I've printed off reams of stuff with H in it, so I can read properly. That screen was doing my head in. Did Joseph have any luck?
No. And we're nearly through the local list. Looks as if he might not be a Greenborough man at all.
Problem is, not every disappearance is reported as a missing person. And look at the amount of casual labour that comes into this county to work in the fields. Apart from the foreign immigrants, we have a massive number of seasonal workers.
And it's no good asking one of the gangmasters for any names. Those people come and go all the time.
Well, I'm throwing in the towel for tonight before I go completely cross-eyed. I'll look through this in the morning.
He ran a hand through his short grey hair.
I'm having what you girls call a me night tonight, and I don't want to keep myself waiting.
Cat tilted her head to one side.
Oh?
A long cold glass of Bateman's beer, fish and chips and mushy peas with scraps, and my feet up in front of the fire with an old movie. Smashing.
I'm jealous. Have a good one, and see you tomorrow.
Another hour passed. Cat placed all the Miss Purr records in a neat pile on her desk, with a note to say they were all checked, but no possibles had surfaced. Everyone had gone except for Yvonne, who sat in the corner of the office, staring at a computer screen.
Are you going to be here all night, Bonnie? One more coffee and I'll make a move.
Bonnie's voice was soft. She appeared to be lost in thought.
I think my memory has forsaken me. You're overtired, probably.
Cat stared at her friend. Yvonne looked really troubled.
What's the problem?
Yvonne got up and straightened Dave's untidy pile of newspaper articles.
It's the old boy who took his own life. Fred Cartwright. I think I know him, but I sure as hell can't remember where from.
Sleep on it, Bonnie. I know you.
It will surface, it always does. You have a brain like Fenland Constabulary's whole filing system.
It's becoming a rather old brain, and I think it's misfiling.
It is still a damn sight better and quicker than the PNC.
Cat grinned and pulled her jacket from the back of her chair.
Why don't you call it a day? I'm sure you just need a nice glass of wine to reboot your amazing neurofiles.
Wise words, but I'll have that coffee first.
Night, Cat.
Yvonne gazed at the old newspaper articles. Gradually, hazy memories began to stir. Was it that long ago that Charlie Warburton was arrested for manslaughter? It had been one of the town's biggest cases when she was a new probationer. Oh, and the big fire that claimed the historic Greenborough windmill. God, you could see that blaze for 30 miles. It was amazing the memories these pages conjured up. Ah, yes, she'd been there when they unveiled the unbelievably expensive new war memorial. She chuckled to herself. She'd been there the following day as well, nabbing the snotty-nosed kids who had covered it in graffiti. She sipped her coffee and said out loud,
"Now that's a face I recognise. Barnsley. Well, I'm blowed."
Her old sergeant, proudly displaying his bravery award, beamed at her from the page.
"Now there was a good copper, if ever there was one."
"You know what they say about talking to yourself, Bonnie."
Nicky was smiling down at her.
"I thought you'd gone home ages ago, ma'am."
"No, I've been stuck in the super's office for the last hour and a half."
"Did you ever know Barnsley?"
Yvonne pointed to the picture.
"He was a bit before my time, but I've seen his picture on the wall at HQ. He got a commendation for pulling a couple of little kids out of a burning car, didn't he?"
Yvonne nodded.
"Indeed he did. He was one of the best."
"I've met him, actually. He's just moved into the same old people's place as Cat's grandmother. Cat and I called in one day when they had a suspected thief on the staff, and Gran introduced me."
"Well, I'm blowed. Last I heard, he'd retired and gone to live with his son in Yorkshire."
"Cat's Gran said that the son got a new job in the West Country, but Ron didn't want to go. Too far from home."
Yvonne smiled.
"Oh, I must call on him. Where's the place?"
"Silver Court, round the back of Tesco's. Do you know it?"
"Yes. When I get a free minute, I'll drop by. We can go over old times. Great bloke, Ron Barnes. I worked with him quite a lot when I was younger."
Nicky idly leafed through the copies of the old newspapers.
"Were you on this one, Yvonne? The Avril Hammond disappearance?"
Yvonne looked at the clipping and stared at it in silence.
"Bonnie?"
"Oh, yes. I was on that. With Barnsley."
Her boss's voice faded behind the alarm bells clanging in her head. Young Yvonne Collins was back in the village of Quinton O'Dyke on a blustery day in 1985. She was slim and fit, and sitting next to her sergeant at a worn and stained wooden table in a farmhouse kitchen. Across from them sat a man and a woman. Neither looked as if they had slept for a week. They were unwashed, with straggly dirty hair and hollow red-rimmed eyes. Ron Barnes was telling them that, sadly, there was no good news for them, that so far no one had seen their missing daughter. Their shoulders slumped, and the woman put her head into her hands and sobbed pitifully. Avril had been missing for 3 days, and with every passing hour, the chances of finding the little girl grew less. Yvonne sat back in her chair and bit her thumbnail. Images from 3 decades ago were flooding into her mind. She shivered. Suddenly, Yvonne looked up, directly at a very puzzled Nicky Galena.
"Now I know. I know where Fred Cartwright came from.
"Mum, have you got a few minutes? I think this is very important, and not just because of Fred's suicide."
Nicky pulled up a chair. "Go on."
Yvonne drew in a breath. "Avril Hammond's parents seemed devastated by their daughter's disappearance. Barnsley took me along to tell them that we feared the worst. Gladys Hammond was in bits, but she insisted on making us tea. She asked her husband to get the bigger teapot down from the shelf. As he did, he flinched with pain. His hand opened and he almost lost his grip on the big pot. His wife yelled at him, her anger completely out of proportion to the incident. 'If you'd gone to the damn hospital when I told you and not left it a week, you'd not be like that now, you stubborn mule of a man.' 'Lord, Mum, I can hear her now.' Barnsley calmed her down. He guessed that her anguish over her missing child was, as he called it, coming out sideways. The husband sat, nursing his injured arm and rocking backwards and forwards, trying to massage the deformed wrist with the other hand. 'His damaged right wrist, Mum.' 'Are you saying what I think you're saying?' 'I am, because the second thing I remember is Gladys Hammond's rings. When she passed around the cups, I saw she had a ring on every finger. The kitchen was really shabby, and I recall wondering if the diamonds were real. I asked Barnsley when we got outside, and he said, 'Oh, they're real, all right, lass. As I heard it, she married down. Come from a good family, and they didn't think too much of her choice of husband.'"
Yvonne stood up and almost ran to Kat's desk. The picture of the gold wedding ring sat on top of the pile of reports.
"H for Hammond, Mum."
"Do the dates match?" Nicky's eyes glittered.
"I need to check that properly, but I'd say yes. So does his height and that injured wrist."
She rummaged through the newspaper reports on the Avril Hammond inquiry. For weeks, the child's disappearance had been front-page news. Yvonne turned a few more pages, and then she found what she was looking for.
"Listen to this, Mum. Police have confirmed that the jacket found on the banks of the River Westland at Quinton Fen last month belonged to Mr. Gordon Hammond of Quinton Ordyke, near West Saltaby. Mr. Hammond, whose daughter Avril disappeared the month before, has not been seen since the finding of the piece of clothing. From the contents of the pockets and the presence of blood on the jacket, it is believed that Hammond may have taken his own life. The inquest has registered an open verdict."
Nicky exhaled.
"I do believe you have just identified our mystery man."
Yvonne nodded.
"Sergeant Barnes never believed that Hammond had drowned. He said over and over, 'So long as we have no body, WPC Collins, we still have a mystery on our hands.' That body never washed up, or if it did, no one ever reported it. It was certainly never found along this coastline."
"And the girl was never found either?"
Yvonne shook her head. "No, although there were a lot of rumours flying around at the time. People suspected her father of killing her. It was also hinted that he might have been responsible for certain acts of cruelty and possibly two outbreaks of child molestation in Quinton Ordyke, one in the mid-70s and one in the 80s, just before he allegedly drowned himself."
She puffed out her cheeks.
"And that's where I know the name Cartwright from, Mum. He lived in Quinton Ordyke at the same time as Gordon Hammond. I'd need to find my old notebooks, but I think we interviewed him."
Nicky squeezed Yvonne's shoulder.
"Well done, you. For the first time in 2 weeks I can go home happy, in the knowledge that we're actually getting somewhere with something."
She stood up.
"Now, you get away and give that amazing brain of yours a well-earned rest. Tomorrow, we can really get to work." "I'm just going to call in on Fred Cartwright's neighbour on the way home. She'll not be able to get out and walk that little dog, and he'll need to stretch his legs."
"Above and beyond as always, Bonnie." Nicky smiled warmly. Chapter 6. A shrill ringing pierced the night silence and made Nicky's heart race. She reached out of bed for the phone, which gave the time as just before 1 in the morning. She immediately thought of Joseph. Did he want to talk? Or was it the station? Not another death.
"Spooky?"
Nicky leaned back against the pillows.
"Kind of late for a chat, isn't it?"
"Sorry, Nicky, I know. But, well, I saw something tonight that you need to be aware of. I've been out on the marshes, up on the sea bank, just sky-watching, you know." Nicky did know. Spooky took her nickname from her curious hobby of watching the night sky. She tracked the stars, identified constellations, but mainly she was looking for UFOs. Spooky was a living, breathing X-Files episode. Spooky was also a well-read, intelligent, specialized computer programmer. Sometimes with Bliss, sometimes with her dog, and sometimes alone, she would spend the hours of darkness out on the marshes, staring at the sky. Always hoping. Around 11:30, the sea mist came out of nowhere, so I jacked it in for the night. Bliss had just rung me, saying that the local weather station had warned of thick fog on the Lower Marsh Road, so I headed home via West Saltaby. There was a pause, and Nicky shivered slightly.
The boggy fen village of West Saltaby was not her favourite place. Anyway, the fog was just as bad there, so I finished up crawling along the back roads at 20 or less. I passed Dr. Sylvia Caulfield's home and saw a load of cars outside. And maybe she was having one of her famous fundraisers. That's what I thought, until I realised that it was nearly midnight, and I saw whose cars were parked there. Azina Paris's Merc, Rosemary Allsop's Toyota SUV, Maria Lawson's Peugeot, Anna Blunt's Beamer, Sammy's Mini Cooper, one I didn't recognise, but I think it belongs to Grace Campion. They all belong to High Echelon Briar Patch Woman. And you think that's suspicious? We are always notified of meetings by text, and I receive nothing. This gathering was a very select few. So it looks like your assumption may be correct, and they are planning something. Oh, hell, just what we need in the middle of an inquiry. Are you still on it? Yes, my superintendent assures me that there's no problem. That's a relief. Spooky's voice dropped almost to a whisper. Sorry to ask this, Nicky, but the papers hinted that Madeline died violently. Is that true? Was she really badly mutilated? Nicky sighed. I'm sorry, Spooky. I know you liked her. Yes, I'm afraid Madeline did not die peacefully. Although from what I saw, I doubt she knew much after the first few blows, if that's any consolation. Poor Maddie. We will get whoever did it, I promise you that. I just pray that the Briar Patch women don't get in the way. Nicky yawned. Look, thanks for the information. I really appreciate it. Oh, and good luck with your interview. Keep your fingers crossed for me, hey? You'll sail through. Cross them anyway. I hear that I'm up against several other techies with motherboards for hearts. Nicky smiled. From what I know about you, you have a heart and a motherboard, so it's in the bag. Nicky ended the call and snuggled back beneath the duvet. She lay wondering about this elite band of women. They could certainly unearth things about Madeline Prospero that a bunch of coppers would never be able to dig up. Perhaps she could find a way to use them. Maybe there was a weak link somewhere in the group's hierarchy. Spooky was likable, and the group probably trusted her, but only so far. Her friendship with D.I. Nicky Galina was not exactly a secret. No, Nicky needed an ally, someone in the group with authority. Reciting the list of names had the same effect as counting sheep, and Nicky's eyes closed. Tomorrow she'd go over every name again. There had to be someone. Nicky opened her eyes. Who do I know with enough sangfroid to walk right in and join that select company? She whispered to herself. A smile slowly spread across her face. Of course. Eve Anderson. The smile widened. Eve would revel in it. She was attractive, very intelligent, and a bloody good actress, and she was fairly new to the area. No one knew they were mother and daughter. Perfect. Nicky sat up and swung her legs over the edge of the bed. She needed to make a few notes. Spooky had said that prospective new members needed to be nominated, then seconded, and she or Denise should be able to sort that for her. Of course, it was by no means a given thing that Eve could gain the confidence of the top women, but if anyone could, she could. Nicky padded across the bedroom and paused at the window to look across Cloud Fen to Knott Cottage. She could hardly wait to tell Joseph of her plan. Nicky's eyes widened, and she moved closer to the window. Knott Cottage was clearly visible. There was no fog on this part of the fen, just a misty haze. There, parked just off the lane and gleaming under Joseph's security light, was Laura's bright red 4x4. Nicky glanced at her clock. It was 1:20. Her heart sank. She yanked the curtains together, returned to her bed, and curled up in a fetal position. Nicky tried to tell herself that she had no right to dictate what Joseph did with his life. They were not an item, and if they continued to put their jobs first, they never could be. So why did she feel so devastated? There were a dozen valid reasons why his ex-wife should visit Joseph. Nicky knew you should never assume anything, but it didn't help. She fought back tears. Spooky also lay awake. She could not stop thinking about Maddie. She had been so unassuming, so quiet. Spooky had never seen Maddie drunk. Never heard her raise her voice or pick an argument. Maddie was just there, never seeking out the spotlight. Spooky felt terribly sad that Maddie's death had been so violent. She turned over again.
"Worried about your interview?"
Bliss asked sleepily.
"I'm fine. You go back to sleep, babe." "Sweet dreams."
Bliss closed her eyes again. But Spooky's dreams were not sweet. They were full of menace, of some impending nameless horror. When she woke, tired and unrefreshed,
All she could recall of them was an image of Madeline Prospero standing at the top of a tall concrete building. Her flimsy grey dress fluttered around her thin body. Spooky was down in the street calling up to her, shouting at her not to jump and begging her forgiveness for giving away her secrets. But the words were torn from her mouth and flew away. She could make no sound. She remembered screaming silently as the ghostly figure pitched forward and plummeted out of sight. Chapter 7. The team, plus Professor Rory Wilkinson, sat in Nicky's small office listening to Yvonne Collins relate the story of Quentin O'Dyke's reign of terror and the disappearance of Gordon Hammond. The village is in the back of beyond, a farming community still isolated and suspicious of strangers. You can imagine what it was like 30 years ago. Yvonne raised her eyebrows. Sergeant Ron Barnes took me along so I could get a feel for what policing was like in this strange county. It was my first posting, and, believe me, it was a real shock to the system. Some really terrible things had happened there by all accounts, but no one would talk to us about them.
Like what? Asked Kat.
Oh, animals disappearing, then turning up dead, having been tortured. Little children so badly frightened they couldn't even say what had happened to them. Some had possibly been interfered with, but the relatives refused to allow any medical examination. Wherever we went, we met a wall of silence. Yvonne stared at one of the notebooks she had brought with her. Gradually we began to notice that everything seemed to revolve around one particular family, the Hammonds. It eventually emerged that everyone in Quentin O'Dyke believed that Gordon beat his wife. Gladys was often seen with bruises or a black eye, and that led to concerns about their only daughter, Avril. The villagers came to the conclusion that she was either a second target for Gordon or an unwilling witness to the abuse he subjected her mother to. Whatever, she was so traumatized she found it almost impossible to make friends, and although she was highly intelligent, she struggled at school.
And then she disappeared, Dave added.
She was a teenager, still at school, there one minute and gone the next.
And the village decided that Daddy had killed her?
Kat asked.
Without a doubt, although at the time he seemed totally devastated. Both Barnes and I believed his anguish was real, but we never found out why he was so distraught, whether it was because he had lost his beloved daughter, or what he had done to her.
So, asked Nicky, when he allegedly drowned, did the villagers decide that it was out of remorse for what he'd done to his daughter?
They did.
Except he didn't drown, did he?
Rory gazed up at the ceiling. I hate to say this, Mom, but I think we need to go back to Quentin O'Dyke. Yvonne looked thoroughly miserable at the prospect.
We certainly do. From where I'm sitting, it rather looks as if the menfolk of Quentin O'Dyke didn't wait for an arrest and a trial, and took things into their own hands, staging his drowning.
Joseph nodded.
And actually executing him and burying him in a disused cemetery. Rough justice.
First, we need to confirm that our mystery man definitely is Gordon Hammond. Can you do that for us, Rory?
Nicky looked at him. No problem at all. Perhaps someone will be kind enough to hunt out the old evidence box with Hammond's jacket and possessions in it. I've already taken a DNA sample from the bones, and you mentioned some blood, Yvonne.
Yes, Professor, on his jacket and on his knife. It's right here in my old notes. Good thing I was so wordy in those days. There's a lot of info in the reports.
Haven't exactly changed then, have you?
Joseph smiled at her.
Shame others can't do the same.
Nicky didn't look at Joseph when she spoke. Joseph looked uncomfortable.
Oh, absolutely, Mom.
Nicky frowned and returned to her memo pad.
Nice work, Vonnie. There's very little doubt as to who our skeletal friend is, so we can start making some preliminary inquiries while we wait for the positive identification. We'll work on the assumption that someone in the village knows what happened. Dave, would you please get out that old evidence box and send it over to Rory? Yvonne, I'm going to need a list of the villagers whose children were potentially abused. In fact, we'll need another list of everyone who was in Quinton at that time. Then we'll sort out who's dead, alive, or gone away. Kat, I'd like you to pull out all the old files and reports on Avril Hammond. The case was never closed. Right, any questions?
Just one, for Yvonne, actually.
Joseph turned to her.
How many families do you think were affected?
Oh, well, hard to say without checking the case notes, but most likely 10 or possibly more.
Joseph pulled a face. So, a fair proportion of the village would have liked to see him dead.
Yvonne gave a wry smile. Except for one man, Cyril Roberts, a local butcher. Other than him, I'd say the whole damn village. From what I recall from our interviews, Cyril was Gordon's only friend in Quinton O'Dyke, which leaves ours with one hell of a list of suspects.
Kat grimaced.
Great. It's always the same, isn't it? No suspects at all, as with the Prospero case, or too bloody many like this one.
Rory laughed. Not often you get an entire village on the suspects list, is it?
Nicky nodded. It's a first for me, I have to admit. But at least we can't complain about having nothing to do, can we?
She stood up.
Meeting over, guys. Get to work. And Joseph, if you would stay, please, I want to talk to you.
Ben Radley is being briefed by the superintendent, Joseph. As soon as he's finished, I'd like you to show him the ropes. I know he's been here before, but that's not the same as working here permanently.
Nicky wasn't looking him in the eye, and her tone was chilly. This wasn't like her at all.
Of course, said Joseph. Is there anything in particular you want him to start working on?
Fred Cartwright's daughter. Yvonne has had no luck with the airlines or the local hotels. Not surprising, really. Millicent may have got married since she left home, or maybe just changed her name. With no recent pictures of her, she's not going to be easy to trace. But he can start with that. Check local hotels, too, for any visiting Kiwis. We do have Millicent's maiden name, her date of birth, and the year she left for New Zealand, plus an old address in Christchurch. It's not much, but it's something.
Okay. Maybe he could check again with the old neighbour. Ask her whether Fred mentioned expecting a visitor, or anything at all about his daughter.
Joseph paused, still aware of the icy draught blowing his way.
Owen, why don't we put a notice in the local paper asking for anyone who knows of the whereabouts of Millicent Cartwright to contact us? Ben could deal with anything that comes from that.
Okay, I'll leave that to you.
She said no more, and Joseph realized he had been dismissed.
He took a deep breath.
Nicky, look, about last night I...
Not now, Joseph. I have a lot on my mind. Can it wait?
Joseph bit his lip, nodded, and left. This clearly wasn't the right time for a heart-to-heart, but it was clear that Nicky had been looking out of her window the night before and seen that red car.
The door closed behind Joseph, and Nicky's mobile rang. Yes, Spooky. Just a quick call. I know we asked you for Sunday lunch, but Bliss wondered if you could make it for supper this evening instead.
There would be nothing to stop her, would there? No cosy meal with Joseph. No intimate chat over a glass of wine.
Yes, tonight is fine. But why the change of plan? Well, there's something wrong. No, not really. Just something Bliss came up with. About what I told you, you know? We just felt we needed to talk to you sooner rather than later. I'll see you around 6, if that suits.
Perfect.
See you then. Nicky hung up, wondering what Spooky and Bliss wanted to talk about. Spooky had sounded odd. Nicky shrugged and glanced up at the wall clock. She should go and tell Superintendent Greg Woodall the news about the mystery man. He'd no doubt be pleased at how quickly the corpse had been identified, but not so happy when he heard how many people had wanted him dead. She gathered up her notes. In the end, it would probably all be a process of elimination, and a lot can happen to folk in 30 years. 30 years of history to dredge through. For a moment, the Prospero investigation didn't seem so bad after all. At least it was a recent murder. Then she remembered the state of Maddie Prospero's battered body, and changed her mind. Nicky stared at the closed office door. She should have let Joseph explain. But she had felt so angry, so left out. She was scared of losing it and saying something she would regret. She knew her reaction was totally over the top. It was probably something completely innocent. It was hardly professional to give him the cold shoulder at work, either. She just couldn't seem to help herself. She had not even opened her bedroom curtains that morning, so she had no idea if and when that red car had left. Oh, God, this was so stupid. She needed to sort this out before she turned into some kind of bunny boiler. With a fierce shake of her head, Nicky picked up her notes and walked out of the office. Dave placed the musty-smelling cardboard box on the pathologist's desk.
Sorry about the dirt, Professor. You should see the state of that evidence facility. It took me over an hour to locate it.
He brushed cobwebs from the sleeve of his jacket and rubbed the toe of a shoe on the back of his trouser leg. Rory ran a sharp knife around the lid and peered inside. With gloved hands, he carefully removed an old tweed jacket, laid it carefully on his bench, and smoothed it out. It had a heavy, dank smell. Next, Rory took out the evidence bags. These yielded a fob watch, a pearl-handled pocket knife, a handkerchief, a cheap metal bottle opener, a couple of long nails, and a length of thick twine. Rory spoke softly to the jacket.
"Now, my beauty, what secrets can you tell me, I wonder?"
Dave half expected it to answer.
"Blood.
The good constable mentioned blood. Now where...
The pathologist lifted each dirty brown sleeve in turn.
Where, oh, where? Ah, here we are.
Dave followed the professor's pointing finger. It indicated a small darkening of the material on the front edge of the jacket, close to the buttonholes. Rory raised the flap to reveal a large, irregular stain on the thin lining.
Is that it? Said Dave.
Not exactly a bucketful, is it? But it's plenty for me to work on, and... Oh, do look.
Taking a pair of tweezers, Rory lifted a single short strand of hair from under the worn and faded collar.
Perfect. Root as well.
Rory positively glowed. This man should really get a life, thought Dave.
How long until you get a profile, Prof?
Patience, dear friend, patience.
It's just that I don't want to spend days chasing around asking questions about the wrong bloke, do I, Prof?
When it's through, I will deliver it personally into your own fair hands, I promise. Will that do?
Rory looked at him over the rims of his glasses.
So you've no idea how long it will take?
Dave suppressed a sigh.
What is time, detective? Time travels in divers paces with divers persons. As you like it.
Not quite as I'd like it, Professor, but I suppose we can't have it always, can we?
Rory grinned at him.
I'll get all this photographed and see what else we can find out for you.
Dave muttered his thanks and turned to leave.
It is Friday tomorrow, Detective, so tomorrow afternoon, if you were very lucky. All right?
Dave gave him an exasperated smile and pushed through the doors. Chapter 8 Spooky and Bliss lived in a three-story apartment over a gift shop in the middle of Greenborough town. The cobbled lane where the Victorian building was situated was called Salem Alley. Spooky loved it and thought the name incredibly cool. Bliss had looked into its history and had only come up with a reference to sallow or willow trees, no mention of witches at all. Every time Nicky walked down the narrow lane, she was transported back to Victorian times. At some points, the old buildings practically touched each other at roof height. Spooky was always saying that Tim and Dougie, who lived opposite, could easily clean her windows if they leaned out far enough. Before Nicky rang their bell, she glanced into the mullioned window of the gift shop. It was full of trendy, colourful things that drew your eye and had no useful purpose whatsoever. Interesting presents to give, but not so thrilling if you were on the receiving end.
"Come on up, dinner awaits!"
A tinny voice from the speaker made her jump. The door released with a clunking sound, and Nicky traipsed up the twisting flight of stairs.
"Hey, little Miss High Security. I could have been anyone. You opened the door before I even said who I was."
Nicky tried to assume a suitably policeman-like expression.
"Saw you coming, Detective Inspector Marm. Our front bay window looks down to the end of the alley." "Oh, rats. Here, have this bottle of wine for being so observant." "Very nice. This looks a damn sight better than what I've got in the fridge."
Spooky grinned and added, "The dog hasn't seen you for a while, so look out for a big welcome." This was followed by an excited yelp, and an elderly collie came skidding across the polished floorboards, sending rugs scattering in every direction. Nicky bent down and cuddled the excited creature.
"Oh, and I've missed you too, Scully. Still being starved, I see. Right, you two go take a pew in the lounge while I see if Bliss needs a hand to dish up."
Nicky sank onto a deep, soft couch and gazed around the room. There were candles on every surface, and clusters of pebbles and crystals. One wall was given over to a huge tapestry hanging from an oak pole, and the floor-length curtains were of a similar tapestry design. It was a lovely old room at any time, but Nicky liked it best in autumn and winter, when there was a roaring fire in the grate. Nicky settled back and marvelled at how relaxed she always felt in the company of these two women. She spent most of her time dealing with criminals, liars, cheats, bullies, and occasionally some truly evil people. This couple was a real antidote to her working life. There was no pretense with them. You knew exactly where you were. It made Nicky feel safe. She heard footsteps on the stairs.
"In your honour, we're eating in the rarely used dining room. So, if you would please like to join us?"
Spooky made a sweeping bow and led the way down. The dinner was absolutely delicious, reminding Nicky of how much she missed Joseph.
"Do you know, I'd forgotten what home-cooked food was until Joseph arrived in Greenborough. The Indian takeaway loved me so much they used to send Valentine's cards. I think I would have starved if it hadn't been for my microwave."
Shame on you, Nicky Galena. Dreadful things. They nuke every ounce of goodness from the food.
Bliss tried to look stern, but failed.
Want some more coffee? Then we can go back to the lounge and talk.
Settled once more on the sofa, Nicky waited for someone to speak. Clearly this was not an easy subject to broach, and the woman remained silent. Scully crept up beside Nicky and pressed against her. She pushed her grey muzzle into Nicky's hand and gently licked her fingers. Stroking the dog and looking at no one in particular, she said,
"So, who is going to tell me what's worrying you then?"
They both began to speak at the same time, and then stopped. Nicky took charge.
"Okay, Bliss, you first."
Bliss smoothed her long, multicoloured skirt and looked up.
"It's about the members of the Briar Patch Club. We've been talking about what they might be up to."
She paused and gazed across at Spooky.
"I have an idea my little drama queen here may be wrong about them turning into vengeful angels. On reflection, I believe they are meeting because they are frightened. I think they are forming a watch committee because they believe that Maddie's was not a random killing."
Spooky nodded.
"I agree with Bliss. I reckon that they are scared shitless, worrying about who will be next."
Nicky weighed this up.
"So why not come to me? Well, to the police? I know that some of these women have no wish for their sexuality to be broadcast throughout Greenborough, but we would do our best to be discreet. If they think they are in danger, well, surely..."
"With respect, Nicky, what if there was a leak? How would you feel if you were one of those women, and you saw a headline declaring to the world that the redoubtable Detective Inspector Nicky Galena was a dyke?"
Nicky knew exactly how she would have felt.
Point taken. But I would like to know why they consider themselves to be in danger. It seems that Madeline Prospero was indeed the target, and not just someone in the wrong place at the wrong time. But there was nothing at the scene to indicate that some homophobic creep was trying to pick off influential lesbians one by one.
"I might be able to tell you more after Monday."
Spooky sipped her coffee.
"I had a text message that there was going to be an urgent meeting at 8:30 next Monday night at the Patch. It said all members should make every effort to attend."
"Sounds promising, doesn't it?"
"It does. And I'll make sure I'm there. But I also heard that the elite women, Sylvia Caulfield and her close friends, may be meeting again at her home beforehand."
"I wonder why."
Bliss folded her arms.
"It must be to decide how much to divulge to the members at the meeting on Monday."
Spooky shrugged. "Yeah, it's probably a case of how much do we tell the children. And I have no chance of gatecrashing that one. Well, just go to the main meeting then. Will you ring me as soon as it's over?"
"Try and stop me. The thought of some weirdo spying on us is giving us both the screaming abdabs. We've even rigged up a code with the two gay guys opposite, you know, Tim and Dougie. If we hitch up the left-hand lounge curtain onto the window catch, then call the old Bill."
Nicky laughed.
"What were you planning on doing? Telling your intruder to have a seat while you just go and adjust your drapes?"
"Don't mock. So far it's the best we could come up with." Spooky looked put out.
"I'd keep thinking if I were you. But seriously, don't get too worried. There really is nothing to indicate that the killer is after anyone else in the group. Just go to that meeting and find out why the women are so troubled, okay?"
Nicky smiled.
"What does it feel like to be a copper's snout?"
Spooky grinned.
"I prefer to be called an undercover sleuth, thank you. Hey, in the movies they get paid, so what's all this worth, Governor? A pony? A ton? A grand? Would you settle for a pizza or a family-sized tub of ice cream?"
"Deal."
Bliss stared in horror. "You're not serious. Do you know how many preservatives they put in those things?"
"Joke, Bliss. If Spooky comes up with something good, I will take you both to the best restaurant in town, with the freedom of the menu.
How's that?"
"We'll hold you to that. And by the way, Miss Dead Clever Detective, supposing you suggest something better than our lifted curtain sign?"
"I guess it's not that bad, really, but if I were you, I'd agree on an object you could place on the windowsill. Then remove it if you needed help. You can easily pretend to knock it over if someone takes you by surprise."
Nicky looked around and saw a good-sized chunky candle on a flat base. It was scarlet, orange and white, and would be easily visible from across the street.
"This would do, but I really don't think it's necessary, you know."
"You are most likely right, but thank you.
And Tim and Dougie are dying for a bit of drama in their lives. They'll really enjoy seeing all those hunky young uniforms dashing down the alley. Tell them not to hold their breath. We only have two good lookers, and they're not in uniform."
They chatted for a while, and then Nicky remembered her trip to Xena Paris's antique shop. She told them about her sighting of the daunting Xena, The two women fell about laughing. That wasn't Zena. That was her manageress, the delectable Miss Harriet Page, a.k.a. Harry the Rottweiler. Still giggling, Spooky ferreted around on a shelf and returned with a photo album.